Okay, please give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Kyler from the Downtown Young and Sober Home Group.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
So I'm not standing on my tippy toes. Perfect, thank you. Okay. Hey, what's up, everybody? My name is Kyler, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Kyler.
Okay, not a problem. Before we begin and we fiddle with the mic, I just want to thank everybody for being here and having a meeting on this holiday. It's truly an honor. But anyway, I'm going to begin with saying I am more than an alcoholic. I'm an addict of many kinds. And I'm going to talk about dry goods in my story. That is not to defile the sanctity that we have in these rooms, but because it is a huge part of my story and also part of the message that I wish to convey. So for some housekeeping, my sobriety date is the 18th of June, 2024. I had the honor of picking up one of my one-year chips in this very room. I have a good friend who was a sponsor and a sponsor who was a good friend. And I'm very honored to have them both here with me today. My home group is Downtown Young and Sober, and I love them to death because they really did save my life. So, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a line that I think of very often, especially when I think about my story and how I'm gonna share it. And it's, the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. And I was an extreme example of an extreme example of self-will run riot. So a little bit about my family history. Alcoholism does run in my family history. We are Irish, so I guess I should have seen that coming. My grandfather's brother actually died in a tragic incident involving a bus when he was drunk. It's still not known today whether it was a suicide attempt or an accident. And my mom and her brother are both still practicing alcoholics. When I was young, I discovered my first ism was World of Warcraft. It was the thing that I could use to escape reality and would give me that ease and comfort. And my mom saw that in me, and she would tell me often, you have the gene. You have the gene of like an alcoholic, an addict in you. And I didn't like that very much. I was always someone to take umbrage to that. I wasn't even sure something like alcoholism could be passed down genetically. It always seemed like a choice to me. But I was a very shy, small child. I was afraid of people. I would always have my nose in a book or playing video games. That was how I sought my ease and comfort. My very first drink that I had was sophomore year of high school. It was at a cask party where I had some awful flavored vodka. I believe it was like cotton candy flavored or something like that, Smirnoff. But it gave me a feeling that I've never felt before, a warmth that I've never felt before. And in that cast party, in a small kind of like cramped hotel room that everybody was able to put together for, I ended up making out with this really beautiful senior girl. She was one of the cool girls too, one of the popular ones. And here was me, shy, timid, afraid of people. And here I am hanging out with the upperclassmen and doing bold things, like making a move on the girl and it working out. Me and her even actually ended up dating. So I thought I found the solution to my problem. Senior year, or maybe it was junior year, I actually think it was junior year of high school, my mom found the stash of alcohol that me and my friends had kept in the basement. And she relapsed after that. She had a good amount of years sober. Most of my life, she'd been sober up until that point. And to this day, she still drinks. That is a burden that I have carried with me for a long time, but have been able to find acceptance in with this program. But the summer of senior year, I started hanging out with the public school kids. I originally went to a Jesuit Catholic high school, and I love that place. The Jesuits were great people for me. But when I fell in with the public school kids, I was privy to a world that I had always known about, but had only been able to see on TV. You could say I probably romanticized it. We did a lot of smoking weed, occasionally cocaine, but it was mostly just weed, you know, nothing too crazy or harmful. But one day, they went to a dealer who they thought that they were getting cocaine from, and it was actually a bag of meth. He says he got it mixed up. Whether that's true or not, I can't really say. But when they realized what had happened, one of the friends in our friend group, he'd actually been recovering from a meth addiction. And so he took one look at that baggie and he said, you know, I know how to smoke this, and I have an oil burner at my place. And so I figured, why not? So we went, I smoked meth for the first time, and I'm not gonna lie, it was a lot of fun. The come down was awful, but here I was, just partying, no end in sight, no consequences as of yet, especially because I had to go away to Philadelphia to go to film school. And so, you know, I had my fun and then quickly extracted myself from the situation. In my mind, I did it once and my life wasn't ruined. All of those kind of like DARE programs and people that say meth not even once, I had evidence that they were wrong. So I was fully convinced that I am not an addict. In college, I was more interested in partying than studying. Once again, it was mostly weed, occasional drinking, a lot of ketamine and LSD. But I remember very vividly one day, I just picked up a good amount of ketamine, and my girlfriend at the time, we were trying to figure out like who would get so much of the drug. And I began to really nickel and dime her for the amounts. And as soon as I recognized that, I was kind of like, ooh, I don't like that. You know what, you just take the whole baggie. I'm not an addict, but that's kind of like addict-like behavior. And I don't like that. I'm not an addict though, because I can do that. Because I can recognize that in myself and I can say, you know what, you better just take the whole thing. I'm better off without it, just for a little bit. I'll take a break. Then I ruined her birthday. I got belligerently drunk on a bottle of vodka. That was my first time blacking out and something else came over me. I don't mean to diminish my responsibility in it, but I literally became a man possessed. I still have scars on my hand from punching the wall repeatedly until my hand bled. One of my few moments of lucidity, I remember a group of our male friends pinning me to the bathroom floor and spitting in one of their faces, and me just being the 5 foot something guy I am, somehow able to just kind of resist these big guys. I gave one of our female friends a concussion in that bathroom. I don't remember that. And you know what I did? I blamed the vodka. I said, I'm not an alcoholic, but vodka makes me violent for some reason. So I'm gonna switch to whiskey. That seems more like a gentleman's drink. I'm not an alcoholic. So while I'm still at college, I start changing majors, drifting from one thing to the other. I don't really know what I'm doing with my life. Tuition's really high. I didn't have any scholarships to Drexel University. And so I realize I don't know what I'm doing and it's crazy to make my parents just kind of like pay for this. So I'm gonna drop out and go home. If I'm being completely honest though, I think what I really wanted to do was I just wanted to party with my friends back home. Go back to the drinking and drugging and smoking weed. When I got back home, everyone was hooked on crystal. I tried to revive the good old days, but it just wasn't gonna happen. In the big book, it talks about, Bill talks about his heroes being the leaders of business and finance. Mine were the criminals, drug dealers, and prostitutes. My I have arrived moment was when I started selling crystal when all of my friends were trying to get sober. I don't remember much from that time, but I do remember the last time I picked up. I was driving back home down Highway 85, just picked up a baggie from my dealer, and I realized, you know what, this isn't fun anymore. I've had enough. And so I threw the baggie out the window, never looked back. Is that something an addict would do? I would say. No, I was not an addict. I used my self-will to stop using. However, in less than a year, I started dating this girl, and I'll never forget the morning after we hooked up. She grabbed a bottle of wine that we'd been drinking the night before and took a big swig first thing in the morning. I'd never seen anything like that. Even when my mom was drinking, she was never a morning drinker. She had her rules. You don't start drinking until 5 p.m. So I saw that, someone who starts their day off drinking, and that's what I got into my head. That's what an alcoholic looks like. I'm not an alcoholic, I would never do that. Starting your day off with a drink? That's crazy. We started using heroin together though. And she moved in with me and my parents. And I found myself having to start my day with taking a hit of heroin. Our relationship dissolved, predictably. She moved back to Sacramento to live with her mom and try to get clean. And she made a pretty good go at it, actually. But one day, it was January 27th, 2018, I heard she relapsed and overdosed. Kind of same with my grandfather's brother. Don't know if it was an accident or on purpose. She is one of many people I've lost to this disease. And we must never forget that what we deal with in these rooms is life or death. We are the lucky ones, the miracles of mental health, and it is our duty to continue to carry that to help other alcoholics and addicts. During one of my attempts to get clean, I had friends and strangers come over for some good innocent fun, just drinking and smoking weed, nothing hard. The next morning, we woke up and my old man's Silverado was gone. I still, to this day, honestly, have no idea how that happened, but he blamed me for it. And once again, my self-will took over, because I told him I had nothing to do with it. Why wouldn't he believe me? Like, I'm telling the truth, I'm trying to get clean and sober. Like, here I feel like I'm doing everything right, completely neglecting that I've put this man through hell and have given him no reason to believe in me. But I was so hurt and offended that he didn't believe in me this one time, that I stood my ground and he stood his, and it got to the point where he kicked me out of the house. Even though I've threatened him, saying that if you kick me out, I'm probably going to relapse. Fortunately, I had a friend whose family let me stay with them during this time, and they were good people. They were really good people. They showed me it was possible to have a happy, loving, functional family. Before I stayed with them, I just thought that was some nonsense that was on TV. I didn't think that that was an actual experience people had. And it was kind of like my first wake-up call of kind of like, oh, my family is dysfunctional and that's atypical. So I tried doing the right thing, doing right by them. I worked for my friend's mom. I stayed clean during that entire time I lived with them. And I was able to resolve things with my parents eventually. And I moved back in with them. That day, that very day I moved back in with my parents, I started using again, immediately. It was literally, I sat down in my room and I was like, cool, I'm no longer living with the good people who I feel accountable to. I can do what I want again. That self-will just jumped right back into me. So strange, because I was getting so much better at life, but I was so delusional. I was so delusional and just wanted to do what I wanted to do. I soon began stealing from the cash register at the store that my friend's mom hooked me up with the job. My friends gave me an intervention of sorts. They asked if anything was wrong, and I stubbornly told them no, and even if anything was, I wouldn't be asking for help. I'd like to say it was shame. I just didn't want to say, yes, I relapsed and I'm using heroin again. and my life has become unmanageable and I'm scared and I need help. And while that is probably partially true, the truth of the matter is I just wanted to keep using. And I knew that if I was honest with them, I would have to stop. So they disowned me after that, predictably. I burned that bridge. I tried supporting my habit, just working, restaurant jobs, mostly. But it was never enough. I would often resort to stealing my mom's credit card to buy gift cards that I could then exchange at these check cashing places for cold hard cash for a pretty steep discount. I don't even know how I figured out that you could do that, but people say necessity is the mother of invention. Addiction is truly the mother of invention. I still refused to believe I was an addict throughout all of this, though. All of this insanity, all of this craziness that I was doing, anything I can do to get my fix. Stealing from good people, stealing from my family, burning bridges, not being honest, hurting. Doing nothing but hurting, all just because, all in the name of my self-will, all in the name of what Kyler wants to do. But I refused to say I was an addict. If the withdrawals just weren't so bad, that's what keeps me coming back to it. It's the physical dependence on it. I'm just someone that likes to party and it got out of hand, a little crazy. But you know, if there was just a way to ease the withdrawals, just make the opioid not so potent when it's leaving my body and I don't want to die, and I'm sweating and throwing up and can't sleep and just crawling out of my skin, if there was just a way to ease that, I would stop. I got a pretty heavy dose of reality. One of the things that is still my favorite memories to this day is going on RV trips with my family. Because they are probably the only times that I was clean in my 20s. And I have a very vivid memory of the time, I'm trying to remember what park it was that we were going to, but the name escapes me right now. But we were driving out to some national park in California, and I had just taken my last hit of heroin in that morning, and I could feel the effects starting to wear off, the withdrawals slowly creeping into me. And I would do this countless times, because I'm like, I'm going to go out into the woods, there's not going to be a dealer or any sort of drug or anything for like miles. Like, there's no way I'm going to be able to find a fix. This is what's going to get me clean and sober. And as we're driving to the campsite and I'm starting to feel the dope sickness overtake my body, I start cursing myself for being so stupid and short-sighted once again, as I always did. And I'm just looking out the window and I'm crying out to God. I'm praying to him. And I just say, God, just please take this sickness from my body. I'll do whatever you want me to. Just, I can't keep doing this. Just do something. Take that withdrawal away, because I'm not an addict. If you take this withdrawal away, I'll stop. And I can still remember it so clearly. I was looking through the passenger window, sitting right next to my old man, looking up at the trees as we were driving by, and all of a sudden, it was just gone. All the pain, all the sickness, it was quite literally lifted from my body. I had the spiritual experience that I had prayed for many times in withdrawal, but never got. And it finally happened. I remember on that camping trip, I was so stunned when we got to the campsite, and we were right next to this beautiful lake. And I went away from my family, because I was just kind of like stunned and having a spiritual experience that I couldn't really share with them. And I found a place alone to just sit and contemplate some things. And out of nowhere, this old man just kind of like sneaks up behind me. Actually kind of startled me a little bit. And he said, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to sneak up on you. I'm trying to find a spot by this lake where I used to come to as a young man. And that gave me a lot of peace and comfort. And I'm just trying to find it again. And I was just completely mesmerized by his presence. There was something so good-natured and good-willed about him. I saw God in that man a little bit. And to this day, I like to imagine maybe one of these days I will go back to that lake and find some kid sitting by the lake, and I'll be able to walk up to him and say, "Hey, sorry, I didn't mean to sneak up on you. I'm just trying to find a spot by this lake that used to give me comfort when I was a younger man." I would love to say that I didn't use after that, after this spiritual experience, after this gift from God that I had been given. But I did. As soon as we got back to the city, it was the first thing I did. It was the first thing I wanted to do. I still thought I was in control and that I ran the show. I used for many years, and it took me many dark places. And I'm not going to go into all the insanity and the details, because it's nothing new. I'm going to skip ahead to January 27th, 2022. This was 4 years since my girlfriend's death, when she overdosed on heroin. And here I was, in the exact same spot I was 4 years ago. I was disgusted with myself, and also confounded. I was amazed that all those years had passed, and I hadn't done nothing with my life. I would love to say that I was even just running in circles, but I wasn't doing that. I was just sitting in my own filth and addiction and mess that I had made. I quit heroin cold turkey that day. No rehab, no medication. Once again, just pure willpower. I did smoke heavily marijuana over the past few months, but I started to kind of wake up from the darkness that my life had been, and I realized I needed to do something with my life. Working in restaurants was good for a junkie who needed a paycheck to get his fix, but it's kind of a dead-end job. What am I actually going to do? So I got the bright idea that I'm sure many a young man has gotten in their head when they're feeling aimless and they need purpose and structure. I enlisted with the U.S. Navy. Now, of course, I was smoking marijuana at the time, but I quit that because, once again, I'm not an addict. I still have that notion in my head. In the Navy, I went to the A school with the highest second highest attrition rate, just behind Nuke School. It was a very challenging training environment, very fast-paced. A lot of people didn't make it. A lot of people dropped out for one reason or another. I began drinking to deal with the stress. And drinking, it was insidious because it didn't start every day. At first, it was just kind of like, you know, three-day weekends or when going out with friends. Then it started every weekend. Then it was every day, unless I had a test the next day. That was my rule. But then it became every day, even when I had a test coming up. I don't know how I passed that A school. But I did. And I'm now a rated CWT, Cyber Warfare Technician, with the Navy. And I come to Virginia for my first command. And meanwhile, I have this looming, overwhelming imposter syndrome. So the training I went through was so fast-paced and I was so intoxicated for most of it, I didn't feel like I really deserved it. I felt like I just kind of stumbled into this. I came into a toxic work environment, too. I'm not going to go into too many details, but essentially, they had just lost their certification. It was a big deal. Like I said, not going to go into the details of it, but nobody was happy to be there when I arrived. It was also my first time living alone. I always thought that that was something I would enjoy, but it ended up being more of a hurdle than I thought it was going to be. Just maintaining an apartment, running out for groceries. When I was in A school, I was at least living in the barracks. Small space, easy to keep clean. And if I didn't want to go out for groceries, you always had the galley. The command I'm stationed at right now doesn't have such things. It's more of a collection of office buildings, actually, right down the road some. So Yeah, the stress of living alone really, really got to me. I also missed my friends from A school. That was something that I wasn't expecting. Being in the military, I kind of knew people were going to come and go. It's just the nature of it. And I knew that they were going to leave and I was going to leave them. Like, I logically knew that. But it wasn't until I was in Virginia and didn't know anybody except my girlfriend at the time that I realized how unprepared I was to leave them and how much I would miss them. Also, with the amount of drinking I was doing, I was overweight. Part of being in the military is they do a body composition test right before the physical readiness test. It was pretty embarrassing for me to be just over the line where they had to do what they call taping you. They actually grab the tape and measure your stomach, measure your neck, just to see if you're under that line, if you have to lose any more weight. Thankfully, I wasn't that much overweight, but that was humiliating. Someone who had always been, you know, skinny from drugs most of his life. Now here I am, fat from alcohol, and feeling just like a slob most of the time. I mentioned my girlfriend at the time too. The relationship was falling apart. She was going through a divorce at the time, which in hindsight it was short-sighted to get into a relationship with someone in that position, but hindsight's 20/20. But the stressors of it, because we were both in the military, her ex-husband was in the military, and in the military, it's actually, she's still technically married, so you could get a UCMJ for the situation that we were in, and so we had to keep the relationship secret, and that also stressed me out. My mentor died too. His name was CWT1 Momarts, Stephen Momarts. Whenever I went to funerals before for people I didn't know, they would always go up there and say, you know, like, this guy, he was a great man. It was kind of like a paragon of virtue. He was a great sailor, the ideal. He was perfect. And every time I've sat through one of those where I didn't actually know the guy, I would always think to myself, this guy can't be perfect. Like, what about all the messed up stuff that he did that nobody's talking about? I'm sure there's plenty of that. Just me being angsty and jaded, frustrated, as is my wont. Stephen Momarts actually was pretty darn close to a perfect man. He was a great sailor. I didn't ask him to be my mentor. He just saw me as a junior enlisted sailor, and he was just like, I'm your mentor now. He really went out of his way for me. And his death was so unexpected. I was anxious all the time. I still remember during my promotion to E4, standing in front of my whole department and just shaking like a leaf. I even asked one of my friends afterwards, after everybody shakes your hand, wishes you congratulations, blah, blah, blah. I was like, could you see me shaking up there? He was like, yeah, it was pretty visible, even from as far back that they were standing. I never once thought that it was the alcohol, though. I just thought, you know, I'm at this new command, all the things that I listed before, toxic work environment, missing friends, first time living alone. That's why I'm so anxious. I would look at my peers, and they would have all this energy. They would just be able to attack the day, and here I was, wanting to kill myself every day. Never once did I think it was the alcohol. I just thought I'm anxious and depressed. Because after all, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not an addict. January 2024, I make a New Year's resolution. I'm not an alcoholic, but I am drinking too much. So I decide I'm going to stop drinking. Just take a little bit of a break. Use my self-will once again. Hasn't failed me yet, so I think. After 2 weeks being completely sober, I decide I'm doing pretty good. I know the next day I have a short day from work. I decide I'll treat myself. You know, here I am, 2 weeks, I can do this. I go out and buy the biggest bottle of tequila I could find. I get back to my apartment, and I don't remember what happened, but I remember waking up the next day, and there was just a little puddle of alcohol at the bottom of that bottle. First thing I think is, whoo, last night got a little crazy. But, you know, I won't do that again. That's the last time I'm going to do that. That's fine. Don't worry about it. Like I said, had a short day at work. Decided to go to the commissary to grab some groceries. Honestly, thank God for that because while I was at the commissary, I had a seizure. It must have been the weirdest combination of alcohol poisoning and alcohol withdrawal. I was taken to the ER and the doctor said it was alcohol withdrawal. I don't, because I've been 2 weeks sober, I find that hard to believe. I think what happened was I went from drinking every day to cutting cold turkey to then drinking the most tequila I've ever had in a single night. And my central nervous system just did not know what to do with all of that. So the doctor, he tells me he's going to give me a prescription, benzodiazepine. But he tells me, if you drink on this, there's a very high likelihood that you could stop breathing. And I say, no worries. I wanted to cut back on my drinking anyway. I'm not an alcoholic after all. It should be fine. Of course, I drank on that medication. And I didn't stop breathing, so I kept doing it some more. During this time, my girlfriend was just being a sweetheart. She ran out and got some groceries for me. She came over to my apartment, and she wasn't even looking for it. She was just being helpful. She was putting the groceries away, and she found the bottle of tequila that I was hiding. She took the bottle, and I begged her to at least let me keep a flask. And I did that because I had just bought that bottle, and I was embarrassed to go back to the liquor store and buy another one. I knew I was fully capable of that, but I just begged her, at least let me have a flask. I'm not sure I can make it through the rest of the night without at least a flask of alcohol, at least something. I pour the flask, I give her the bottle, and she tells me to give her the flask. And I say no. She tells me to give her the flask again, and I say no once more. She asks one more time, and I say no again. In all my years of heroin addiction, I had never felt that low and that ashamed and that scared because of what this substance had done to me. That was truly my lowest point. And I knew what that moment was. I tried rationalizing it in the moment. I'm kind of like, if she told me it was an ultimatum, I would have given her the flask right away if I knew it was between her or the alcohol. I knew. Of course I knew. I was just lying to myself, being delusional. At the time, she was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I chose the alcohol over her. And I am still confounded by that choice to this day. This substance truly is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It took a couple weeks. I could just sense that something was off. So I texted her, told her, hey, I feel like you've been more distant recently. She tells me, yeah, there's a reason for that. We need to talk. It was January 28th, 2024. 6 years to the day that Stephanie died. 2 years since I've been clean from heroin. She told me that she just needs time to process her divorce. Maybe spend a year single. It's kind of the ultimate, it's not you, it's me. I mean, what can I really say to that? And you know, I start thinking in my head, okay, like this hurts, I don't want this to happen. But you know, you're single, she'll work on herself, I'll work on myself. Obviously we both got some problems that we can work on. In a year we'll come back together and it'll all be fine and dandy. Ride off happily into the sunset. A week later I hear that she's dating somebody else. And so I decide I'll convince her to come back to me. I'll convince her that I'm her true love, that this guy is just a placeholder, a little distraction for right now. And how I'll do that is by getting sober. Self-will has never failed me before, right? I quickly became insane. This was my drying out period. I was obsessed with her. I wanted to know where she was all the time. I was trying to figure out just crazy ways to manipulate me into running into her, whether it was like on the streets of Norfolk, at work. Started showing up at her apartment a couple times unannounced. That didn't end well. I was literally driving myself insane. And that's one of the things that I think of to remind myself that I am an alcoholic. Because when I stopped drinking, my life didn't get better, it got worse. I still remember very vividly on the phone with my old man. I was talking about how I felt like a junkie all over again. It really did feel like the heroin days. I was pacing around in my apartment, just white knuckling my way through this, just being kind of like, I gotta get over this girl. One day this feeling's gonna pass. One day this kind of like tense, uncomfortable, this discomfort is gonna leave my body. I just have to hold through, but then also trying to think of any way possible that I can get my fix, that I can get her back in my life. And then all of a sudden I had this epiphany. It all of a sudden just became as clear as daylight to me. And I remember saying on the phone with my dad, just out loud, oh my God, I'm an addict. It was the first time in my life that I was actually finally able to see that. I had just traded one substance for another my entire life. Started out with meth, I quit that, started using heroin, and I started using weed, then I started drinking alcohol, and now my new substance was this girl. And that's when I realized, oh, I might be truly effed. That night I went to my first meeting, and I heard something that I had to at that meeting. I was downtown Young and Sober, was now my home group, and somebody described the feeling of having a God-sized hole inside you that you were trying to fill with all of these things. And I was very lucky to hear that at my very first meeting, because I got to have the experience of, yes, that's me. That's what is going on with me. And that just might be my solution. So I threw myself into this program because, quite frankly, I was terrified. And I needed saving. I needed saving bad. And I saw all these people who were happy and joyous. And I never thought in a million years that I would be one of them, that I would have friends like them, that I would have the energy that they have. But I had faith. I had faith that maybe it was possible. So I did what they told me to do. I got a sponsor. I started doing the steps. And I was actually pretty amazed that the desire to drink did fade away. Up until this point, I had been white-knuckling it through everything. But the feeling for my ex-girlfriend never did. And it was right before I had to go to the Navy's substance abuse rehabilitation program in relation to my seizure. Took me a really long time to get into that program, but Navy doesn't do many things fast. I realized I wasn't doing step three in regards to her. I was still praying to God to have that relationship work, to have her come back into my life. I still thought, in regards to this, I ran the show, and we were destined to be together, and God wants us to be together. I'm pretty sure I've said that more than once to my therapist. And I realized, after a pretty bad emotional relapse with this girl, I was like, oh, I haven't really turned my life and my will over to the care of God as I understand Him. And I realized I was just paying lip service to it the whole time. I was like, okay, I need to do that. And so, as I said, it was right before I went to the rehab program. And I committed that my goal in rehab was going to be to get over this girl. I'd done pretty good with the alcohol thing. I think it was 4 or 5 months sober at that point. I was feeling pretty comfortable about it. I even had the pleasure of teaching some young men about what AA has to offer, taking them through the steps. I'll also never forget the one time we usually have AAs come into the room, have a meeting for us. They didn't come one night, and a bunch of them came up to me and they said, hey, could you help us lead a meeting? I said, yeah, I'd love to do that for you. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. It was day one of SARP when I had made this decision to actually fully turn my life and my will over to the care of God in regards to everything, including the one thing that I really wanted to manage and I thought I knew best for. I had surrendered completely. And day one, she texts me. Yeah, I can't make that up. She says she's done being mad and she would like to be friends again. I sat on it for a couple weeks just because I kind of didn't know what to do. I eventually invited her to come visit me in rehab and we talked and it was good. She apologized for how she treated me during the breakup. She saw where she was in the wrong there. I got to apologize for some things I wasn't proud of. She did say her and her boyfriend had broken up, and that's where she realized that how he was treating her was how she treated me, and that wasn't fair. That's not how you treat another person. So she told me she's going to work on herself, and we can work on the relationship when she gets back from her deployment. I was over the moon, and I was super ecstatic. I felt like the promises were coming true for me. Here I was, I surrendered my life and my will over to God, and man, he delivered exactly what I wanted to. Like, this stuff is crazy. First couple months were good. Me and her are texting back and forth because that's something you can do on the ships now. But self-will slowly crept back in. I'm super embarrassed to admit this, but I wrote it down on the flashcard, so I'm going to say it. I bought her a pair of lingerie that I just saw, and I was like, she would look really good in this. Here I am, once again, I've got everything planned out, everything's going my way. I grabbed my self-will back. Texts started getting fewer and far between. I could kind of tell something was up, but I just had to have faith. And I was like, God wants this relationship to happen, right? She came back to me, right? St. Patrick's Day, which has always been a hard day for me, because I'm Irish. And I like drinking. She texts me, and she tells me that she has a crush on somebody that she's working with on the ship. And she's going to tell him how she feels, see if he feels the same way when they get back from deployment. I was devastated is an understatement. But I didn't drink over it. And that, to me, is a miraculous testimony to what this program can do. I am still in disbelief that I did not pick up a drink during that time. The old me would have picked up a drink if I had stubbed my toe. I'd have been like, oh, this day's shot, time to go have a drink. And here I was going through one of the most emotionally devastating and raw times of my life. And I refused to drink over it because I had changed. I don't know when it happened, but I had. During this time, what I did instead of drinking was I prayed. I prayed like crazy. I had no idea what God's will for me was, but I prayed for knowledge of it and the power to carry it out every day. And I'll never forget a very particular night. I was up in the Appalachian Mountains camping with some friends. And while we were going on a particularly long hike, I was doing one of my prayers to God. Just being like, God, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what you want me to do, but man, I really need you right now. Like, I need a sign, something clear. Just tell me what you want me to do and I'll do it. Do you want me to try to rekindle things with Emily? Do you want me to start dating other people? Do you want me to just work on myself? What do you want me to do? And clear as day, a single word popped into my head, and that word was wait. And I hated that. I was not a fan of that. I was like, no, God, give me something to do. I need a direction. Don't just tell me to wait. That's okay. Taking my will back. If that's your will for me, I'll wait, even if I hate it. And so I did. I waited. And now I get to tell one of my favorite stories that I got to tell. And I call this the flat tire story. I was seeing Rocky Horror Picture Show with a group of friends. and I was driving a friend back home, and unfortunately, on the ride back home, my car hit a flat tire on the highway. And at this point, it's 3 a.m., like, nobody's awake. I get out of the truck. I'm able to walk down the highway just long enough where I can kind of, like, find a way to climb over it, the railing, get back on the surface streets. Miraculously, there's a single Uber driver driving around, and I get home, and I'm just like, I just want to sleep in my own bed tonight. We'll figure this out tomorrow. I'm using my self-will to do all of this. I'm just pushing myself forward. Self-propulsion is my guiding force through all of this. I wake up the next day, have a friend drop me off at the truck, and I'm still trying to self-will my way through it. So I'm like, I'll figure this out. Like, I'll call roadside assistance, and they'll be able to bring a spare tire, right? I call them up, and they say that they can switch out a tire if I have one, but they can't bring me a spare tire. So I'm trying to figure out a way to get a tire, and I'm trying to do this all by myself because that's the only person that I can rely on, and self-will has always gone right before. Fortunately, I had a group of friends in the AA program who I was supposed to play Dungeons & Dragons with that night. And so, you know, I text them, and I'm like, hey, guys, I don't think I'm going to be able to make it. Car has a flat tire on the side of the highway, but, you know, don't worry about it. I got it all under control. Unfortunately, they called me up, and they said, with way more swear words that I'm not going to use, but they said, forget you. Tell us where you are. We're going to come rescue you. And so I told them. And when they were on their way over, I wanted to cry. I felt like a scared little kid. And I was just so embarrassed and so ashamed. All that pride and stubbornness came crashing down around me. But when they showed up and they helped me, slowly, these little miracles started to happen. The first miracle was that the very last lug nut that was keeping the tire in place, the flat tire, it was stripped. So it was honestly a miracle that we were able to get that off in the first place. Took some good effort, but I was really scared for a minute there that once we realized how janky that lug nut was, I thought we were just dead in the water. But we got it off, and obviously we need a replacement at this point. So we go down to the AutoZone, and we show the guy at the counter the lug nut. And we say, hey, can you get us something in this size as a replacement? He goes into the back, and he comes out holding a box, shaking his head, but with a big smile on his face. And he shows me the contents of the box, and there's literally one lug nut left of that size. I was like, oof, man, we got really lucky there. Then we get to the Walmart, where we're gonna have them switch out the tires, flat one for a new one. But when we get there, there's only one guy working at the counter. And he tells us, hey, sorry, there was some emergency for everybody. Everybody left for the day. And I can sell you the tire, but we need two people here for accountability reasons in order to switch it out. So, you know, I'm just kind of rolling my eyes and thinking, okay, this doesn't kill the entire plan. I mean, it's a pain. We got to go to another tire place, have them switch it out, pay another hefty sum of money. When they could just do that here, but it's whatever. And as I'm slowly starting to just kind of like come to terms and accept this, this guy comes out from the back out of nowhere. And he just says, oh, no worries, man, I got you. And so he takes the tire back to switch it out. And as the first guy I was talking to was finalizing the transaction for everything, he tells me, that guy said he was going to be out of here at 4:30. It's 5 o'clock right now. I have no idea what he's still doing here. So there's the other miracle. We were able to switch out the tires right before it started raining. Like literally, it started sprinkling right when we got that done. So I count that as a miracle. And then at that point, me and my friends had worked up an appetite. So we went out to have some food at some Korean barbecue place. And it was such a beautiful night. We talked a lot about our experience, strength, and hope, about what we were like when we were drinking, what happened, and what we're like now. It was such a beautiful dinner, such a nice night. And, you know, we hug, we tell each other we love each other, and we start going our separate ways. And I park in the parking garage, and my apartment is about like a block away from the parking garage that I park at in downtown Norfolk. And there's usually just an alleyway that I like to cut through, just because it makes the trip a little bit faster. And I don't know what came over me this day. Like, something just kind of like jumped into me and said, no, you know what? Don't take the short way home. Take the scenic route. Like, walk down Granby Street. You're having a pretty good night. Might as well enjoy it a little bit longer. So I walk down Granby Street, and as I'm walking, just kind of like thinking about how much I love my friends and how lucky I am and all the miracles that happened today, I see this weird, long mustached man with glasses peeking around a lamppost, just staring at me. And I double took, and I was like, Tyler, what are you doing here? Turns out he's having dinner with another group of our friends at a restaurant right next to my apartment. But I would have walked right by it. I wouldn't have seen them if I hadn't decided to take that alternate route for some reason that day. And so I spent the rest of the night hanging out with them and just soaking in the fellowship. And that's when I realized that this is why God told me to wait, because he just showered me with all of these blessings and signs today. And what I learned from that God told me, is that everything will be fine, you are loved, and you are surrounded by friends. And just in case you didn't get that, we're gonna give it to you a second time. And I'm so thankful for this program, for my friends, for the ability to be patient and not drink when things are going bad, but to wait and to have faith in my higher power, and instead of trying to do things my way and living life propelled by self-will, living in accordance with God's will. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks for sharing, Tyler.
Our Southern tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Money collected to this meeting covers donations to the church and supplies. The rest is given in the Tidewater Intergroup, District 24, in the General Service Office. Are there any AA-related announcements?
Hi, Tyler. Hey, Tyler. You're probably going to hear this every week until the end of the month. But there's events July 26th, 27th, 28th, and 30th. Scout Cabin in Portsmouth having a cookout on the 26th. A101 down in Norfolk. It's pronounced Norfolk, by the way. At the Centerra Hospital, 10 a.m., they're having a meeting in the Heart Hospital. There's going to be a lot of bacon, so it's convenient. And then Appalachians, just up the road from there, is having a speaker at Singen. And then West Kent is having their half anniversary, and a guy named Frank S. is going to tell his lies. There's also going to be food there, I think, 6:30. If you guys need any more information, let me know.
Thank you.
Jacob Dowell, our part.
Hey, Jacob.
Tyler, thank you so much, and thank you for supplying this month's list of speakers. Next July, next Friday, July 11th, is George P.
Correct.
So please come out and hear George.
I'll be here. Or the door will be open. Okay, besides speaker meetings on Fridays at 8 p.m., we also have a big book study on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. And I've asked a friend to present chips.
All right. Tyler, great job.
Thank you.
I used a lot of drugs too, so... I felt you on every one of those. Drugs are part of my story. Alcohol was the start of all of that for me. And it was the end. You know, when all the drugs were gone, it was easy to go get alcohol and just keep that party going. So I am truly an alcoholic. So thank you for sharing your story. I wish we had more people. I'm glad that you did choose July 4th because it's a hard one to get people to come to because everybody's doing their thing. So
appreciate it. We got a chip system. This is the white chip.